yet gone from listener to supporter, please do so now. Give online at kpfk.org or call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
Well, good afternoon, friends, good friends and listeners. We're happy you joined us again this week here on the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Maria Hall. I think we've got a very special and good show for you today. I think we always try to do that, but I think you'll be particularly interested perhaps in today's show. Maria, prove me right on that. Let our audience know what, in fact, if they stay tuned, they're in for.
Of course, yes. Thank you, Jim. Sorry, just turning on the video here and not that our listeners can see that, but hi, everyone. Good afternoon. Yes, today, tune in because we're going to be first speaking with attorney, law professor, and LA Superior Court judicial candidate, Luz Herrera, about community access to the legal system and justice. And then in our second half hour, we'll be speaking with John Raefling, senior researcher at Human Rights Watch, about a new report called You Have to Move, the Cruel and Ineffective Criminalization of Unhoused People in Los Angeles.
Well, and I think our first topic, unusual for us this week, listeners, but because of an airline change, our guest had to very quickly pre-record the interview with Maria this morning that we had hoped to do together. So we're going to play that interview for you. If you don't hear my voice, it's not because I'm suddenly being more polite. It's just because I wasn't part of it this morning. And when that interview is done, then we'll get to that second topic that Maria talked about. But you stay tuned as we play this first. And I'm sure I'm looking forward to hearing it too, first segment.
With so much focus on the upcoming presidential election, it's easy to lose sight of the important local issues and races we'll be deciding in November. Even though local issues and candidates impact our lives in an arguably more direct way. And not only that, in Los Angeles County, our local issues and candidates can have national and even international reach. So getting to know what's on our ballot here in LA is both a responsibility and a privilege of which we should all take ownership. Now, one section on the local ballot that's sometimes glossed over is the one on judges for LA Superior Court. I think that's because there's less information available on the candidates, so voters worry they can't make an informed choice. The ballot just shows the names and professions, which, spoiler alert, is usually judge or lawyer. We don't even know their party affiliation. So who are the people asking us to elect them to be a judge in the largest court system in the country and probably the world? Who are the ones asking to decide our private and public disputes, the ones who render punishment or show mercy? How do we know whose values and perspectives reflect our own? To help us answer these questions and others, I'm so happy to introduce one of the judicial candidates whose name will appear on the LA County November 5th ballot, Luz Herrera. Luz is a nationally recognized attorney and law professor with a lifelong track record of advancing access to justice. As a member of the California Bar for over 20 years, Luz has advocated for families, nonprofits, and entrepreneurs. After graduating from Stanford University and Harvard Law School, Luz took the path less traveled, back home to Compton, where she started her own solo firm aiming to serve Spanish-speaking clients. Luz then founded a nonprofit organization called Community Lawyers, Inc. to serve residents of Compton and Southeast LA. And later on, when she was teaching at UCLA School of Law, she co-founded the Los Angeles Incubator Consortium to give support to new law graduates who wanted to do what she did, provide affordable services to clients of lower and moderate income in their own communities. And full disclosure, I am the director of that program, the Los Angeles Incubator Consortium. Luz Herrera, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm glad to be here.
Sure. Now, before we begin, of course, we want to let listeners know that KPFK is a nonprofit organization and does not endorse any particular political candidates or measures. We're just getting out the information. So, Luz Herrera, before we get into your decision to run for LA Superior Court judge, talk about your local roots. What are your ties to Los Angeles?
I trace my roots back to the 1930s when my paternal great-grandmother immigrated from Jalisco, Mexico to Los Angeles. Even though she came during those times and built a very successful Mexican food business, my dad did not immigrate till the 1960s, and it was in 1965 when he met my mother, who had was visiting to help a relative care for a child. They met in the 1965 and ended up getting married and stayed in Los Angeles. So I go back to those times. I grew up in the East Side communities. My parents met in East Los Angeles, and my first, 4 or 5 years were spent there. Then we moved to Montebello and Whittier, and most of my upbringing was in Whittier. And so that's where most of my closest childhood friends are. I came back to Los Angeles after law school and after working some time in San Francisco, and set up a law practice in Compton. So spent a good amount of time there, and still am involved with Community Lawyers, an organization that I founded in 2005. I serve on the board. And so, most of my friends and family that are part of my fabric are in Los Angeles.
Oh, well, why don't we stop and talk a little bit about your educational path from Southeast LA to Stanford and then Harvard Law? I can only imagine that you encountered classmates from very wealthy families. Did you find role models and other support there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think most schools, have a range of students. So you have the very, very wealthy, but you also have individuals who are, very poor and had very humble upbringings. And so there's a range of individuals, but I did have a wonderful support system that was really centered around Tony and Cecilia Burciaga, who were amazing mentors to a lot of first generation students. And in particular, a lot of students who were Mexican American, like I identify. And so they were amazing support for me. But not only that, we also had a number of faculty members that to this day I keep in touch with and really helped me gain confidence in myself. So, this idea of being an imposter, I think oftentimes people talk about that in a very real way. And it's not that I haven't encountered it, but there was a community at Stanford that made you feel like you should belong there, that you should be there. And I'm very grateful to the support system that was there, because it not only helped me get through Stanford, but I think it gave me the confidence to succeed and go on to law school.
Well, I think I recall something about the Vicky Carr Foundation as well. Was that one of your scholarships that you received?
Yeah, so I received the Vicky Carr scholarship when I was a high school student. Oh. And I used that money, right? I think it was like $1,000, but that's where I bought my very first Apple computer. Wow. The first personal Macintoshes that came out. That's what I used to be able to buy a computer so I can write my papers. And that was a wonderful contribution to help me succeed.
Wow. Well, talk about when you first decided to become a lawyer. Was it something you imagined as a young child, or was there a particular event or a person who inspired you to go that direction?
The person that inspired me, the person whose work inspired me is Joaquin Avila. He's a civil rights attorney, did a lot of important voting rights work in the Southwest. But, you know, as I thought about that question, as it has come up in other conversations, I think some of it has to do with just being exposed to the idea of being a lawyer. And I can point to two different times in my early education where we had classroom activities where I had to fill in the role as a lawyer, right? So one was in eighth grade, and it was in my literature class. I forgot the exact story, but it was something called Flowers for Algernon or something like that, right? But I remember that I was assigned to play a lawyer, and the other student who was assigned to play a lawyer is also now a lawyer. Both of us are. And so there was something planted, right? This idea that was planted about law and me. And I don't know if my teacher like saw something in me that led me down that path, or if like, you know, that experience shaped me. But I think that, and then also doing a similar exercise in my history class where I had to play the role of a lawyer in my history class, we were recreating the Nuremberg trials, maybe planted some of that awareness and the seed that might be something that I could pursue. So it was something that was in my mind, but I didn't really know any lawyers. I didn't have any family members who were lawyers. And it wasn't until I was a junior in college, that I finally decided to apply to law school. I didn't grow up my whole life wanting to be a lawyer, but I do remember that, you know, being a lawyer was something that came up as part of my educational upbringing.
Wow. Well, okay. So Luz Herrera, let's talk about your decision to run as a candidate for judge. You know, did you ever play a judge in high school literature class, or was it something that you thought about being, or was it just kind of something that came to you later, sparked by some inspiration?
You know, people had asked me, you know, in previous years, and, you know, have you thought about being a lawyer? Do you want to be a lawyer? And I would always say, no, it wasn't really something I grew up thinking about doing. And no, I never played a judge in any school activities. But I think, you know, what's important about that experience is that the idea can be planted pretty early on, and that role models matter, right? And so I think role models mattering is one of the reasons that I decided to decide to put my name in for the judge election. And it's because I did not see a lot of other Latinas that were running for judge in Los Angeles. And there have been such few role models. There are obviously more now than there were when I was growing up. But I think the role models are important. And I also think that part of the reason why I decided to run now is because it's been over 20 years that I've been practicing. I have much more experience. I've gone, you know, done work in the private sector, in the nonprofit sector, in academia, and so feel much more confident about my ability to handle a courtroom, help manage attorneys, run a docket. Think about all of the different ways in which judges contribute to the community, and I feel like I'm in a good position to do that. So I think part of it is representation, but the other part is just a continuing natural progression of my career of serving others. And I do see being a judge as another aspect of my public interest career.
Yeah. Well, and just if listeners are just tuning in, I want to remind everyone, this is the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm your co-host, Maria Hall. We're speaking this half hour with Luz Herrera, a candidate for LA County Superior Court Judge. Of course, as I stated at the the beginning of the interview, KPFK is a nonprofit organization. It doesn't endorse any political candidate or issue. Just bringing you the information. Another very quick reminder, it's KPFK's summer fun drive. And if you are not a member yet, it's the perfect time to join. A donation of $25 or more is all it takes. And of course, if you're already a member, then turn up the volume on your support by giving a little more. The fate of KPFK and freedom of the press depends on you and me. Okay, back to Luz. So Luz Herrera, LA County Courts, it's the largest court system in the country and probably the world. What do you see as some of the bigger challenges faced by the LA Superior Court? And what are some of the areas where you see some potential?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think there's a lot to handle in a court so big that represents such a diverse population, right? So many different languages that are spoken. So one of the big challenges I do think is language access and being able to make law accessible to the population that the court serves. At the same time, it's an opportunity, right? So if you have so many different people interacting with the court, there are going to be different needs. And so there's opportunity for innovation. I think that technology is going to be an important aspect of the potential that the courts have. We have to lose our fear of it, and we have to find ways in which everyone has a role within technology that allows the courts to become more accessible, but also gives a place to individuals like, you know, court reporters and interpreters and all the court personnel that makes up the courts. But we do have, I think, a responsibility to think about how technology can facilitate legal proceedings as we've seen them done and imperfectly. But, you know, we started that path during the pandemic, and it's something that I think we have to continue to discuss and figure out good options that really serve all of the different interests. But, you know, the judges have seen that there is more participation in the courts because courts are easier to access because through technology, because you can pick up a phone and show up versus having to figure out how to take a bus or find childcare or, you know, walk through metal detectors, which is often a traumatic experience for people. So we've got to think about all of the needs, not just of the personnel who work in the court, but of the people that the court is made for, right? The consumers of legal services, the individuals who have matters that end up in the courts. It's important for us to think about our courts not as a playground only for lawyers and judges, but as a democratic institution that is of the community. And I think continued discussions on how technology can play a role in democratizing our courts is going to be an important aspect of the next decade of conversations, and I'd really like to be part of that.
Yeah, and another something that's been dawning on in the sort of access to justice community more recently is just the place of courts as a place of resolving disputes in a non-violent manner. So when we do see crime and we see war, what are your thoughts on that about how, you know, in a civilized society, I mean, don't we depend on courts to be that fine line between civilized dispute resolution and the alternative?
Absolutely. And I think there are a lot of problems, and we have to figure out how to the balance, you know, kind of the needs of the accused and needs of and the rights of victims. But there's absolutely a role for more dispute resolution. And I think the specialty courts that Los Angeles County already has are important. And we need to continue to improve them, and we need to be able to continue to listen to feedback about what's working for all parties in those courts and what is not. And to be creative about the next version of how we do specialty courts. But courts should not be places to fear. They should be places where people have hope and faith that the democratic system will work and will provide an equitable solution to whatever problem they're dealing with, regardless of the income that they have.
Mm-hmm. Well, back to the idea that we were talking about that, you know, you don't see a lot of Latina judges, for example. According to the Hispanic National Bar Association, just 2.5% of lawyers in the countries are Latinas. And although I couldn't find data on state court judges because it is changing, I did find that fewer than 1.5% of judges on the federal bench are Latina, according to the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Of course, we have a very high-profile federal judge, Sonia Sotomayor, on the United States Supreme Court. But what do these otherwise low statistics tell us about the legal profession and its history, you know, the place where we are at this point in time? And how do you see yourself fitting in?
Well, you know, I don't know that our courts were always made with all of us in mind to participate equally, right? I mean, our Constitution has a very narrow initiation in terms of who was allowed rights under it. And so over time, that has expanded to include women, include, you know, different people, different backgrounds. And I think it's important for us to continue to move in the direction of inclusion in our courts. And again, I mentioned role models and them being a very important element of our judicial system to really help advance this idea of inclusivity and that the courts belong to all, not just those who have money or, you know, those who are most represented in the legal profession, which is still white men, given, you know, the history of legal education and opportunity and economic opportunity in our country. So we see that changing. Obviously, I've been in law schools for some time, and I've seen that change even over my time in law schools, and we see that happening in the courts as well. So yes, the history has not included a lot of Latinas, but I want to be part of that change. It does now include more Latinas and Latinos. We also have to work on inclusion of other groups so that our communities are pretty represented. In Los Angeles in particular, I think it's important to have a representative judiciary.
So speaking of your part of your career has been teaching both law students and young lawyers and coaching them and providing them mentorship. What kind of inspiration do you get from that generation? Are, you know, where do you see the next generation of lawyers and law students taking us? Do they give you hope, or are they making you nervous? You know, how do you feel about what you're seeing?
I mean, I think there's a little bit of both, right? Because all of us are nervous about the unknown, about the future. I mean, they have a way better grasp of technology and the possibilities of it than I do and my generation does. So I'm hopeful in that way that there might be opportunities for them to think about ways to make law more accessible through technology, and also to think about how to open up the profession so that we have more engagement in communities and not just by lawyers in the courts. I think it's important for us to think about alternative ways of resolving disputes, and that doesn't always include lawyers. That might include community leaders, it might include you know, community partners. And so we've got to be creative about how we think about disputes. But this new generation of attorneys has new ideas, and they're not always constrained by what we've done in the past. And that's when I get excited, right? When folks want to take these ideas that have been implanted and cemented in the legal profession and ask questions about it and say, well, why does it have to be this way? Can it be a little bit different? And here are some ideas. Even having those conversations, I think, is really important in helping us think more broadly about the role of law in our society.
Well, we have time for about one more open-ended question, which I could ask you open-ended questions all day, but let's do this one last one. But then I do want to also save time so that people can know how to find you. Luz Herrera, candidate for LA Superior Court Judge. What's been the biggest surprise for you in running for elected office? And what advice do you have for others who might be considering it in the future?
You know, I think the biggest surprise for me has been how little lawyers know about electing judges. I knew very little about judicial elections because so many judges are appointed. But it's not just lawyers. You have 25 to a third of the population that votes that never gets to the judicial races because they don't know who the judges are, right? Or they don't who the candidates are. But also, so I think that that's definitely one of them. I think the other part is just that there's a little bit of a narrow construction of what it means to be a judge. And that we find that sometimes with the repeat players in the courts that don't really think about judges and the role they play as anything other than what happens in the courtroom. That's obviously a big part of what happens or what the role that judges have, what they do in the courtroom. But they also do a lot of stuff behind the scenes, right? They're reading opinions. They're writing decisions. They are conferring with lawyers to help them move cases along. But they're also role models and contributors to access to justice and how we advance the legal profession. And so I've been very surprised that sometimes the lawyers that are most in court think very narrowly about the role of judges. And I hadn't expected to find that.
And then what advice do you have for others who might be considering, or maybe this is the first time they'd ever considered running for an elected office such as judge?
I think it's important for people to consider running for judge and not just applying to become a judge, because it's a opportunity to educate a community that that you belong to about the role of judges and about judicial elections and how it all works, right? Our democratic system is supposed to encourage more civic engagement. And I think this is an area that would really benefit from greater engagement by the general population to understand who our judges are, how they get elected, what brings them to the bench, and what expectations we might have of them. So I think it's an important exercise, not only in learning about the legal profession and becoming a judge, but really learning about our electoral system. And in a presidential election year like we're in today, I think it becomes particularly important for us to encourage everybody to think about the role of judges and how they play into our democratic system.
Wonderful. Well, where can listeners find out more about you and your story?
Sure. Yeah, I have some information on my website, Luz Herrera, find articles and a little bit of a bio and other information about me. So go ahead and visit that site. But I look forward to continuing this conversation and talking more about increasing access to justice and making courts not making courts, but helping courts become more responsive to the needs of the communities. I think we have had wonderful leaders who have done that already. But we always have opportunities for more ideas.
Well, thank you so much, Luz Herrera, candidate for LA Superior Court Judge. We will have you back very soon.
Thank you, Maria.
Nope, I see Jim talking, but he is muted.
Yes, I was just listening. That was quite wonderful. People know so little about judges. They don't know what their jurisdiction is. They don't know what all their authority is in these local judge races. They know nothing about the particular judges. Many of them get backed by this corporation or that union or whatever. And people basically vote blind when it comes to judges. There are groups, that from time to time will recommend certain judges. And if you trust the group, that's of some help. But I think it's important, especially when elections are coming up, to learn more about judges. They play a critical role in the lives of so many of us. even if we're not in front of them, and we know so precious little about them. Well, we're going to get to our next topic in just a couple of minutes, but we do have to do a little piece of administrative work here, don't we? I'm thinking, in fact, this is indeed summer fun drive. And I know people get tired of fun drives, especially on KPFK, because, well, we don't get corporate sponsorship, we don't get government money. So it's fair, we have to do more fun drives than some other public stations do that take that kind of underwriting. Of course, then when we don't take it, we're not beholden to Archer Daniels Midland and all the other corporations that underwrite the programs. So we're very proud of that, but it means that we have to hustle. It means you have to be part of this effort. We're part of the movement for progressive social change in Los Angeles. The voices that you will hear on our station are rarely heard on the corporate media stations. In fact, very often not heard on other public radio stations. We give you the alternative views to the corporate media. That's very precious. I think this is one of the times in history, certainly in my life, and it's been a long life so far, that it's most critically important that we have these kind of alternative voices. Here we are in a presidential year, where on the one side we have the threat of fascism again and totalitarianism, rigging of election, rigging of how votes are certified, all the rest. We'll be talking about that on this show as well as the election season goes on. But right now, what we're talking about is why you should pick up your phone and give us a call at 818-985-5735, or go to our website. That's easy, at kpfk.org. Go to our website at kpfk.org, and have all sorts of ways on there. You'll find out that we thank you when you do this. But we like to think that our program is our program, and all the programs here, our thanks, the most important thanks. As Marie has already said, $25 will make you a full-fledged member. You get to vote in the elections that we hold for our advisory boards and station boards and all the rest. Please do that. Maria, what else should we remember to tell people why this is so critically important?
Yeah, I mean, it really is up to you and to me to keep KPFK loud and on the air, keep us turned up a notch. And, you know, it really is freedom of the press, and it is under attack. We can't go back to sleep. You know, we can't quit our fight for more rights and liberties, because if once you do, they start going away. And freedom of the press is something very important to this show, the Lawyers Guild show. And it's really on all of us. We can't overstate it. I feel like we talk about it a lot, especially during fun drives, but you know, look at where you are right now, where you're sitting. What can you do to change the world for the better? Well, the first thing you're doing is listening. You're listening to alternative voices that you don't get to hear. So please support us. I'm going to do it right now. Once again, like we said, $25 or more clinches that membership, but there are lots of other membership levels, and there are some really sweet thank you gifts as well, including.
There are indeed. I often get off. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just saying there really are some sweet gifts. I often get the music gifts, CDs, you know, with 100 songs on them from one of your favorite performers and so forth. Movies by, some of the good left-wing movie makers who have documentary movies that we make available. Anyway, we're going to get on with our programming now. The only reason we can continue to do that, though, make no mistake about it, is because people like you call and join. I'm going to pledge this week as well. You know, all the programmers here, like Maria and I, are unpaid. The staff is paid half of what they are entitled to. And so it's just you that really keep us going, and that wonderful staff. And so 818-985-5735, or go to our website and pledge, and say you're doing so in the honor of the Lawyers Guild. That always makes us feel good, too. Well, now, speaking of the importance and of voices you're not necessarily going to hear on CNN, although you should, let me talk about this housing issue. It's getting nastier and nastier. You know, back in June of this year, the highly conservative, that puts it politely, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that enforcing laws, that when communities, you know, enforce laws that criminalize unhoused people, even in the absence of any available shelter. Well, that's constitutional. It's okay. Governor Gavin Newsom, a supporter of that draconian ruling, sadly, has since urged all local jurisdictions in California to now destroy unhoused encampments, risking an increased use of such tactics here in Los Angeles and all over the state and county and country, really. Already a number of cities in California, with no other provisions for those who are camping in the streets, have knocked down those tents and such. Let me be clear, the Supreme Court ruling did not only give localities the right to tear down encampments where there was adequate housing or shelter available to those who had been living in the tents, you know, or those cardboard coverings. Oh, no. It gave these cities and counties the right to tear down the encampments even when there was absolutely no government-provided shelter available to those in that community who had been forced by their circumstances to live in the encampments. Well, Human Rights Watch has, of course, condemned this development in the strongest terms. In fact, it was and has issued a 357-page report entitled, "You Have to Move, the Cruel and Ineffective Criminalization of Unhoused People in Los Angeles," which documents the experience of people living on the streets and in vehicles and in temporary shelters in parks in Los Angeles as they struggle to survive while facing criminalization and government failure to provide eviction prevention or access to permanent housing or anything else. So what can now be done to solve this human crisis? Tens of thousands of people are living in the streets of LA. Death rates among the unhoused have soared. What will the LA City Council and Mayor Carrie Bass, an advocate of finding more housing for the unhoused, do in the face of the governor's order, I should say, and the Supreme Court opinion? What are they going to do? What are they going to do with the unhoused? Where are they going to live and so forth? Fortunately, very fortunately, to answer those and other questions, our guest today is the author of that human rights report I just referenced. His name is John Raefeling. He is the senior researcher, U.S. Program for Human Rights Watch. Prior to joining Human Rights Watch, Mr. Raefeling spent years as a deputy public defender in Los Angeles, representing hundreds of poor people accused of various crimes. He also represented political community activists who were targeted for prosecution simply because of their activism. He represented unhoused, homeless people prosecuted for crimes related to their status. He worked as a community organizer. And lastly, I'm proud to say, Mr. Raefeling is a member of the National Lawyers Guild. John Raefeling, a warm welcome to the Lawyers Guild show, my friend.
Well, thank you for having me. Good to see you or to hear your voice, Jim. And hi, Maria. Great to see you as well.
Absolutely. Well, John, the Human Rights Watch investigation that's the basis for the report on the fate of the unhoused in L.A. Went on from August of 2021 through May of 2024. It interviewed about 150 experts, including personnel who'd had experience themselves with being houseless. It gathered an extensive and telling amount of data. And we're going to get into a lot of the details as we go along, but how would you summarize, in broad strokes, the main findings of this damning study?
Sure, thanks. So the first thing is that, well, the process of writing the report and gathering the research and the data started back in 2021 and, you know, just finished now. We look at a lot of historical data. We look at data from the city going back to 2016, but also looking at historical responses to houselessness going back decades. So the broad strokes, the main findings of the report are, first, that mass houselessness in Los Angeles and across the country are caused by housing crisis, right? There simply isn't enough affordable housing for poor people in our city. Two, that there is a solution to this crisis, which is to create more affordable housing, to preserve existing affordable housing, and as you referenced earlier, to keep people in their homes, eviction prevention, and essentially keeping people housed. Third, that while the city and even state policy fluctuates, and sometimes they emphasize housing more, sometimes less, always beneath that, the default policy has been one of criminalization, and that spanned across administrations. And by criminalization, we mean, first, simply by police, the arresting and citing of unhoused people for crimes, not like murders and robberies and rapes, but crimes like sitting on the sidewalk, crimes that target their status of being unhoused, and also crimes like drinking in public or sex work or trespassing that maybe aren't directly targeted at being unhoused, but are related to poverty and are very much used against unhoused people. One important thing that we found is that while the arrests and citations, to get back to the definition of criminalization, it's not just the arrests and citations, which have gone down in recent years, though are starting to trend up with the latest Supreme Court decision and other developments. But criminalization also includes the sweeps by the sanitation department, where they come back by the police and throw people's stuff away. And when I say stuff, I mean a tent, bedding, clothing, paperwork, medications, family photos. And everyone we talked to, I talked to over 100 people who experienced living on the streets. They all had stories of multiple times having their possessions thrown away. And then the final kind of broad stroke conclusion of the report is that this policy of criminalization does absolutely nothing to solve the problems of houselessness for the city, for the people experiencing it, and for the people who are housed who are also experiencing it, and is profoundly harmful to the people and communities.
John Raefling, there have been a number of so-called solutions tried here in LA. I'm thinking of emergency shelters or interim housing or even hotel rooms recently. Are there not serious problems, though, with all of these efforts? Can you tell us about that?
So that's a critical part of what we discuss in the report, is the difference between shelter and housing. And sometimes shelter is called interim housing. And when the politicians talk about, well, we've housed people, sometimes they mean actual permanent real housing, but often they mean a room in a dorm with a lot of other people, or a painted square in a parking lot with a barbed wire fence around it, or a temporary hotel room. So these shelter options or interim housing have their value. They can be very helpful for some people. Some people simply need to get off the streets and into shelter urgently. Six people on average are dying a day on the streets of Los Angeles.
Wow.
But the problem is that for many people, like I said, the shelter is a good option, but it's temporary. For many other people, the shelters are simply unacceptable. They lack privacy. People have to be split up from their partners to enter the shelter. They have their possessions and property is taken away from them. Some of the hotel rooms they have real like habitability problems. And one of the biggest complaints that people have is that the shelters, including the hotel rooms, all come with these very oppressive rules. You have a curfew, you get searched, they can come in your room whenever they want. That these are rules that interfere with people maybe having a job, interfere with people having social interactions. The rules that no adult would really tolerate. So while the shelter, hotel rooms, et cetera, are have their value and are good, they're in no way a long-term solution. And the problem is that there's not enough permanent housing for people to move on to. So if people move into the shelter with this idea that, this is a step. And some people do get into permanent housing, but it's really very few. And so many people end up stuck in the shelter with these challenging conditions and these often oppressive rules, and there's no exit. So they either return to the streets or they stay and languish in the shelters. The other thing I'll add is that the shelters are incredibly expensive, right? Inside Safe, which maybe we'll talk more in detail later, is a hotel room program that's costing $3,500 per month per person. And this is a temporary solution. And then kind of the final, and we discuss this quite a bit in the report, is the existence of these shelter programs. And there's not nearly enough for all of the people who are unhoused, but the existence of them has been used as a justification and legitimization of the sweeps. And so there's this mythology out there that, well, everyone who's being swept from an encampment is being offered housing. Again, housing is not the right word. Some people are being offered shelter. Some people are being placed on a waiting list. But the idea that they're being offered housing or even shelter is used to say, oh, see, the sweeps are compassionate. We're helping people. And that's patently false. Yeah. The sweeps are incredibly destructive and traumatic for people. And while some people are getting into shelter, often that shelter is a dead end and they're just returning to the streets shortly after.
Yeah, thank you for that. I'm also interested, John, in what the Los Angeles Police Department data showed you about that was gathered, what it revealed about law enforcement's impact on the lives of the unhoused in our city.
So law enforcement has a huge impact. And one of the reasons that I wanted to really dive into this topic was looking at in prior reports I did on law enforcement, police would say, hey, we've spent so much time dealing with homeless people, right? So that's not a police problem. That's a societal problem. That's a problem of poverty. So for this report, I interviewed, you know, again, dozens and dozens of people who had been directly criminalized, been arrested, been cited. And they would all tell of being arrested, going to jail for crimes like sleeping on the sidewalk or sleeping on the beach or in the park. They'd lose all their possessions. They'd stay in jail for a few days, sometimes more. And when they got out of jail, they'd be back on the streets again, back committing the same crime that got them thrown into jail. We will have paid all this money to enforce these laws against them. We looked at data. We found that 38% of all arrests and citations combined by LAPD, this is from 2016 to 2022, were of unhoused people, people they identified as unhoused.
Well, let me just, just because that's so profound, I don't want our listeners to miss. If I understood you right, you had 30 of all the arrests made by
all
the
arrests.
CD in a given year.
All arrests and
murder,
citations.
Murder, you name it. Murder, blah, blah, blah. 38% are just for homeless people for these quote-unquote crimes resulting from the fact that they have no place to live.
Well, for all crimes, including low-level things, citations, well, yeah, like for jaywalking and, and littering and things like that. But
right.
The vast, vast majority and the greatest disproportion is in the lower level crimes. For example, sitting on the sidewalk in public space, 100% of those were unhoused people. 100% of drinking in public citations and arrests, right? Maybe you like to have a drink after work or to relax. Well, if you're unhoused, you're breaking the law and you're likely to get arrested or cited for that, right? These are crimes related to poverty and related to houselessness. So a huge amount, and the other thing, this is even more mind-boggling to me, is that of all the citations, and this is the data they gave us, of all the citations, 99% of citations, this is for infraction, sorry, for the lowest level, were for unhoused people. Again, jaywalking, littering, things of that nature. So there's a huge emphasis by LAPD on addressing unhoused people. Now, in recent years, I mentioned this before, total arrests and citations have gone way down by LAPD across the board, including for unhoused people. Again, I say they're still doing the sweeps, but I'm starting to get reports that it's trending upward. And with the Supreme Court decision that you just mentioned that essentially said, green light, you can criminalize whatever you want, including the status of being unhoused, there's great concern that that's going to continue. Now, to her credit, Mayor Bass has said, I'm not with criminalizing. But the sweeps have continued, right? The sweeps have gone on under her administration. And so really the challenge to her is, okay, back those words up and end the sweeps, right? Do good for sanitation to come and do cleanups, but not the sweeps where they're throwing people's stuff away. So this is a real point for Mayor Bass to show where she truly stands on this. She's saying the right things. And she's doing many of the right things, but when it comes to criminalization, that's still happening.
Was the pressure of Governor Newsom when he came out with that? And I know Mayor Bass was kind of an outlier in saying, no, we're not just going to take that party line. But speaking of Mayor Bass, she has made it solving the houseless crisis a major focus of her administration. And you previously referenced the Inside Safe program. What's been the approach of that program and how successful has it been?
Sure. So Mayor Bass has done some very good things on this issue. And we've actually, the point in time count, which is a whole other topic, has indicated some trending downward in terms of numbers, people living on the streets. She's done a lot of things to promote development of housing. The inside, and that's to her credit. The Inside Safe program has some benefits. The benefits are for some people, it's getting them inside. It's getting a roof over their head, and that is helpful. But there's some very strong critiques that we lay out in the report about it. One I mentioned is just the incredibly high cost, right? They've allocated something like over $300 million, and they've gotten a few hundred people into permanent housing. And at the highest capacity in terms of rooms was 1,500, which is better than zero, right? But we've got 35,000 people unsheltered on the streets of Los Angeles. So it's not a solution by any stretch. And you know, I don't think that anyone is saying, well, this is a solution. It has some of the same problems of the other shelter programs that we mentioned. The first is that it's based and it's initiated by sweeps. So the Inside Safe officials will come and they will clear an encampment, right? They will throw away people's tents. They will fence off the area so people can't come back. They've done that in at least a couple of the places that I know of. And tell people, okay, we're going to get you in a room. Okay, well, great. The room may be really far from where you live, where your social connections are, where your healthcare is, but okay, it's a room. The rooms have similar habitability issues. Some are good, some are not good. They have similar rules, as I discussed earlier, that a lot of people, it's really demeaning to live under those kind of rules. The big issue, and again, I said this about the other programs, is it has not had a reliable pathway out of the interim housing shelter hotel room and into permanent housing. And so more people are just going back to the streets than are getting into permanent housing, and the rest are just staying in the hotel rooms. The problem is that it's costing so incredibly much that it's really hard to see that as a sustainable model. And could that $300 million plus have been better used to develop more permanent housing? You know, there's some county officials have said, well, we actually have enough shelter if we have some permanent housing to move people to, right? Once you move someone to permanent location, then the shelter opens for the next person. Anyway, so it's a mixed bag, but some real fundamental problems with the Inside Safe program, which is not to say that it hasn't helped some people.
But sadly, I'm looking at my watch. We're going to be following this. I have a hunch we're going to be following this for quite a while. In fact, it's. You know, when you add the county and it's what, 60,000 or something people living on the streets, and we'll no doubt have you back. I know you're going to be on the national show too that we host. But before I let you go, We haven't had time today to talk about some of the solutions you're but so in your fine report, the Human Rights Watch report, it suggests some practical and reasonable ways to deal with the problem that aren't criminalizing, that aren't stupid, that aren't spending taxpayers' dollars to no useful end, by and large. How do people get a hold of that report? Tell us that before we'll have to let you go.
Sure. And a lot of the solutions are based on housing, sure. Homelessness prevention and housing, which is actually much cheaper than criminalization and much cheaper than criminalization and shelter. Sure. So if you go on the web to the Human Rights Watch website, you could just type in Human Rights Watch. I'm sure it'll come up, but www.hrw.org. The title of the report is "You Have to Move," and it should come right up.
Or just Los Angeles Housing and Human Rights Watch. It'll get you. What an amazing organization! What an amazing job this report is, John. And
thanks, Jim.
I've admired you for some time for your criminal defense work and things. I knew nothing about this, and I'm so impressed. And my hat's off to you. I know Maria's is too. And we thank you for joining us today here on the Lawyers Guild Show, my friend.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Yeah. Thank you. Boy, it makes you angry when you hear a report like that. It's a great report, but I mean, what it's telling us just makes my thin hairs curl. And again, as I say, you're not likely to hear this on corporate radio. They don't want to talk about that. And that's why it's important, is it not, to contribute to the station, to keep the station strong, on the air, our signal strong, our staff paid and happy and healthy with health insurance and all the rest. Maria, I know you and I, all the programmers, like we work, we don't get paid for this. Our staff, as I say, gets paid half of what they should get paid. Our general station manager at the moment isn't taking any pay at all. Bless him. So tell us what people should do about that.
Sure. No, every dollar counts. You know, people who are on the street right now, you know, unsheltered people, they can listen. Also, I've spoken with unhoused people who listen to the show. You know, they still have cell phones and they watch I Love Lucy and they listen to KPFK. You know, that is what life is about. So we need to keep this going for people who can't afford it, you know, right now. Sometimes we can't afford it, sometimes we can't. So if you're in the position of you're listening to the show, you're feeling like you want to be part of the solution, part of something bigger, please join us. You know, Jim and I don't get paid. It is a lot of work. I'll be honest, to do this, to do even just once a week, and other programmers do more than once a week. It is a lot of work, but it's a labor of love. So please join us, help us. Pitch in whatever you can afford. Go to kpfk.org or call us at 818-985-5735 and just let us know that you're listening. Let us know that you're taking what we're saying and you're going to incorporate it in your life and you're going to help us keep the airwaves strong.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the guest we just had on, John Raefling, I know of him, a very fine lawyer, make a hell of a lot more money practicing law and representing people in criminal trials than he could doing what he's doing now and what he's done with most of his professional life. Frankly, that's true of Maria as well. And that's what this station is about. It is not just trying to squeeze a buck for some sponsor.
Right.
It's not just beholden to some corporate underwriting. I would like to turn underwriting as though all they're doing is giving the money to the station. Hell no, the studies that have been done show that when you're underwritten, you're less likely to talk about that underwriter's poisoning of the environment, Archer Daniels, Midland, and all. Well, I use that as an example. You name it, all that corporate underwriting stuff. We don't do that. It's just you. It's just you and us, folks. That's what keeps this station. That's what keeps us honest. That's what keeps it pure. That's why it is a voice. It really is the voice of the progressive movement in LA. We can bring you these voices. We can tell you about this work. We can agitate through the station. We can let guests agitate and tell you who to call to complain about something that's going on with housing and police sweeps and what have you. And no doubt we'll be doing more of that about the police sweeps down the road, by the way. But we can only continue doing that when you pick up the phone, 818-985-5735. Or go to the website. That's a leisurely way to do it, too. You'll see a lot of thank you gifts you know, that you can get depending on 50, 100, 200, 300. And Maria was making a good point. Some of us these days, and some of you these days, can't really afford to do anything, maybe. Keep listening. That's okay. No hard feelings. But if you can, even if you're just 25, do it. And, my friends, if you happen to be doing quite well, and a heck of a lot of people are doing more than quite well, then you might want to give us $1,000 or $5,000, or certainly a couple hundred, for God's sake. You won't even notice. 818-985-5000.